spring upon summer leaves. It was all very peculiar. Not unsettling, but simply unexpected. Especially the fact that his adult life seemed almost completely unknown to him. He knew that in his life he had been happy, also sad. For a long time, he had been very, very lonely. Yet when he tried to reconstruct the circumstances, all he remembered was a clock. For a great while, in this unforeseen and generally pleasant state of unremembering, he made his way down the broad boulevard of sand at the water's edge. The moon, having cleared the horizon, had ceased its upward arc. The tide was high, boastfully so, the sky immense. At length, he became aware of a figure in the distance. For a time, the figure grew no closer. Then, with a telescoping quality, the gap began to narrow. Liz was sitting on the sand with her arms wrapped around her shins, gazing over the water. She was wearing a white dress of some diaphanous material, light as a nightgown. Her feet, like his, were bare. He vaguely recalled that something had happened to her, very unfortunate, though he couldn't say what that thing might have been. She had gone away, that was all. And now, she had returned. He was happy, very happy to see her, and although she indicated no awareness of his presence, he felt very much as if she were expecting him. Liz. Hello. She looked up. Her eyes twinkled with starlight. Well, there you are, she said, smiling. I was wondering when you'd get here. Do you have something for me? In fact, he did. He was holding her glasses. How curious this fact was. May I have them, please? She accepted the glasses, turned her face once again toward the water, and put them on. There, she remarked, with a nod of satisfaction. That's much better. I can't see a damn thing without them. All of this beauty was practically wasted on me, if you want to know the truth. But now, I can see everything just fine. Where are we? He asked. Why don't you sit? He lowered himself onto the sand beside her. That is an excellent question, Liz said. The beach would be the answer. This is the beach. How long have you been here? She touched a finger to her lips. Now isn't that funny? Even just a few minutes ago, I think I would have said for quite some time. But now that you're here, it doesn't seem like very much at all. Are we alone? Alone? Yes, I should think so. She paused. A look of mischief came into her face. You don't recognize any of this, do you? That's all right. It takes a little while to adjust. Believe me, when I first got here, I didn't have a clue what was going on. He looked around. It was true. He had been in this place. I always wondered, Liz continued, what would have happened if you had kissed me that night? How would our lives have been different? Of course, you might well have if I hadn't gotten so drunk. What a self-pitying fool I made of myself. The whole thing was totally my fault from the get-go. At once, he remembered. The beach below her parents' house on Cape Cod. That's where they were. The place where long ago he had let life pass by, failing to say what his heart knew. How are we here? Oh, I think how is not the question. What's the question, then? The question, Tim, is why? She was looking at him absorbedly. It was a gaze meant to comfort, as if he were ill. She had taken his hand in hers without his quite being aware of it. It felt warm as a cup of tea. It's all right, she said softly. You can let it out now. Suddenly, his mind seemed to plunge. He remembered everything. The past reared up inside him, complete. He saw faces. He inhabited days. He lived the hour of his birth and each that followed. He felt as if he were choking. His lungs could find no air. That's all you have to do, is let it out. She had put her arms around him. He was trembling, weeping, such tears as he had never wept in his life. All his sorrows, all his pain, the terrible things he'd done. Everything is forgiven, my darling, my love. All is forgiven. Nothing is lost. Everything you have loved will come back to you. That is why you have come. He moaned and shook. He cast his cries upward to the heavens. The waves moved in and out in their ancient rhythm. The stars poured down their primordial light upon him. I'm here, Liz, his Liz was saying. It's over now. Everything will be all right. Oh, beloved, I am here. It took some time. It took days, weeks, years. But this was unimportant. It would pass in a blink, not even. All things fell into the past but one. And what that was love. 13. The Mountain and the Stars. And thence we came forth to see again the stars. Dante Alighieri, Inferno. 85. Shut it off, Lor said. Rand stared at her, expressionless. They were on the engineering deck, heat stifling, air throbbing with the engine's rhythmic roar. Rand's broad, bare chest shone with sweat. You're sure about this? They were down to their last 10,000 pounds of fuel. Please, Lor said, don't argue with me. It's not like we have a choice. Rand raised the radio to his mouth. That's it, gents. We're powering down. Weir, switch the generator to the auxiliary bus. Bilges, lights, and desalinators only. A crackle, then Weir's voice came through. Lor said that? Yeah, she said it. I'm looking right at her. A moment passed. The thrumming ceased, replaced by a low electrical hum. Above them, caged bulbs flickered, failed, then, as if with reluctance, sparked back to life. So that's it? Rand asked. We're dead in the water? Lor had no answer to that. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said it that way. She made some vague gesture. Forget it. I know you did your best. Everyone does. She had nothing to say. They were 20,000 tons of steel, drifting in the ocean. Maybe something will still work out, Rand offered. Lor ascended through the ship to the deck and climbed the stairs to the pilot house. It was the morning of their 39th day at sea, the equatorial sun already blazing like a furnace. Not a breath of wind moved the air. The sea was absolutely flat. Many of the passengers were camped on deck, huddled in the shade of canvas shelters. On the charting table were the sheets of thick, fibrous paper on which Lor had run her final computations. The currents when they'd rounded the horn had nearly stopped them cold. Running at full throttle, they had barely powered through, huge waves blasting over the deck, everybody vomiting helplessly. They had made it eventually, but day by day, as Lor watched the fuel gauges drop, the cost grew painfully evident. They had stripped everything they could and jettisoned it into the sea. Pieces of bulkhead, doors, the loading crane, anything to reduce weight, to buy one more mile with the fuel they had. It wasn't enough. They had come up 500 miles short. Caleb entered the pilot house. Like Rand, he was shirtless, the skin of his shoulders and cheeks flaking with sunburn. What's going on? Why did we stop? From the helm, Lor shook her head. Jesus. For a second he seemed dazed, then looked up. How long? We can keep the desalinators running about a week. And then? I really don't know, Caleb. He had the look of a man who needed to sit down. He took a place on the bench by the chart table. People are going to figure it out, Lor. We can't just turn off the engines and not tell them anything. What do you want me to say? We could lie, I guess. There's an idea. Why don't you come up with something? Her sense of failure was overwhelming. She had spoken too curtly. Sorry. You didn't deserve that. Caleb took a long breath. It's all right. I get it. Tell everyone it's just a minor repair, nothing to worry about, Lor said. That should buy us a day or two. Caleb stood and put one hand on her shoulder. It's not your fault. Who else is there? I mean it, Lor. It's just bad luck. He tightened his grip, giving her a sharp squeeze that offered no comfort at all. I'll put the word out. After he'd gone, she sat alone for a time. She was exhausted, filthy, beaten. Without its engines, the ship felt soulless, inert as stone. I'm sorry, Michael, she thought. I did everything I could, but it wasn't enough. She dropped her face to her hands. It was late in the day when she descended into the hall. She met Sarah as the woman was closing the door to Greer's cabin. How is he? Sarah shook her head tersely. Not well. I don't see how things can go on much longer. She paused, then said, Caleb told me about the engines. Lor nodded half-heartedly. Well, let me know if I can do anything to help. Maybe it just wasn't meant to be. You're not the first to say that. When Lor said nothing else, Sarah sighed. See if you can get him to eat. I left a tray by his cot. She watched the woman move down the passageway, then quietly turned the handle and stepped inside. The air had an unwashed smell of sweat and urine and sour breath and something else, like fermenting fruit. Greer was lying face up on his bunk with a sheet pulled to his chin, his arms lying at his sides. At first, Lor thought he was dozing. He slept most of the time now. But at the sound of her entry, he rotated his face toward her. I wondered when I'd see you. Lor drew a stool to the edge of the cot. The man was a shadow of a shadow, a shell of bones. His flesh, a sickly yellow, possessed a damp, translucent appearance, like the inner layers of an onion. I guess you noticed, she said. Hard not to. Don't try to cheer me up, okay? A lot of people are doing that, and it's already getting old. Now, what's this I hear about you not eating? Hardly seems worth the bother. Nonsense. Let's scoot you up. He was too weak to rise off the mattress on his own. Lor drew him to a sitting position and wedged a pillow between his back and the bulkhead. All right? He offered a faint, courageous smile. Never better. On the tray were a cup of water and a bowl of porridge, also a spoon and cloth. She draped the cloth over Greer's chest and began to spoon the porridge into his mouth. He worked his lips and tongue hesitatingly, as if these simple actions required tremendous concentration. Still, he managed a good amount before waving her off. She wiped his chin and held the cup of water to his lips. He took a small sip. She could tell he was humoring her. She had noticed, while feeding him, a basin at the foot of the bed, stained with blood. Happy now? He asked, as she put the cup aside. She almost laughed. What a question. Michael picked you for a reason. That's no less true now than it was 39 days ago. Suddenly, the tears came. Oh, God damn it, Lucius. What am I going to tell people? You're not going to tell them anything yet. They're going to figure it out. Probably a lot of them already have. Greer gestured to the bedside table.
"Open that drawer," he said. "The top one."
Inside, she found a single sheet of heavy paper, folded into thirds and sealed with wax. For several seconds, she just looked at it, dumbfounded.
"It's from Michael," Greer said.
She took it in her hand. It weighed almost nothing. It was only paper. But it felt like far more. It felt like a letter from the grave. She wiped her face with the back of her wrist.
"What does it say?" "That's between the two of you. All he told me was that you weren't supposed to open it until we arrived at the island. His orders."
"So why are you giving it to me now?"
"Because I think you need it. He believed in you. He believed in the Bergensfjord. The situation is what it is. I won't tell you different. But things may work out yet."
She hesitated, then said, "He told me how the passengers died. How they killed themselves, sealing the ship and channeling back the engine's exhaust."
"Don't get ahead of yourself, Lor.
I'm only saying he knew it was a possibility. He wanted me to be ready."
"We're not there yet. A lot of things can happen between now and then."
"I wish I had your faith."
"Feel free to use mine. Or Michael's. God knows I borrowed his lots of times. We all did. None of us would be here if we hadn't."
A brief silence passed. "Tired?" Lor asked. His eyes were heavy-lidded.
"A little, yeah."
She put her hand on his arm. "You just rest, all right? I'll come check on you later." She rose and went to the door.
"Lor."
She turned at the threshold. Greer was looking at the ceiling.
"A 1,000 years, he said. That's how long."
Lor waited for more, but there was none. Finally, she said, "I don't understand." Greer swallowed.
"In case Amy and the others fail, that's how long before anybody can go back."
He took a deep breath and let the air out slowly, closing his eyes.
"I'm only saying this because I might not be around to tell you later."
She let herself into the passageway and returned to the pilot house, where she sat at the chart table. The sky beyond the windscreen showed evening coming on. A mass of clouds, as thick and textured as wads of unspun cotton, had moved in from the south. Perhaps they'd be lucky and get some rain. She watched as the sun dipped to the horizon, flaring the sky with its final light. A sudden weariness enfolded her.
"Poor Lucius," she thought. "Poor everyone."
The world could do without her for a while, she decided, and she laid her head on the table, cradling it with her arms, and soon was fast asleep. She dreamed of many things. In one dream, she was a girl again, lost in a forest. In another, she was stuck inside a closet. In a third, she was carrying a heavy object of unknown type and could not put it down. These dreams were not pleasant, but neither were they nightmares. Each unfolded seamlessly into the next, depriving them of their full power. No climax was reached, no mortal moment of terror. And as sometimes occurred, she was also aware that she was dreaming, that the landscape she inhabited was harmlessly symbolic. The final dream of Lor's 39th night at sea was hardly a dream at all. She was standing in a field. All was quiet, yet she knew a danger was approaching. The color of the air began to change, first to yellow, then to green. The hair on her arms and the back of her neck rose, as if with a static charge. Simultaneously, a great wind swirled up around her. She tilted her face to the sky. Clouds of black and silver had begun to form a whirlpool overhead. With a crackling explosion and a biting smell of ozone, a bolt of lightning jagged the ground in front of her, blinding her utterly. She began to run. Sheets of rain commenced to fall as above her, the furious, whirlpooling clouds congealed into a single finger-like cone. The ground was shaking, thunder crashing, trees were bursting into flames. The storm was pursuing her. It would sweep her into oblivion. As the finger touched down behind her, the air was rent by a deafening animal roar. Its power seized her like a fist. Suddenly the ground was gone. A voice, far away, was calling her name. She was lifting into the air. She was soaring higher and higher. She was being hurled off the face of the earth. "Lore, wake up!" Her head jerked from the table. Rand was staring at her. Why was he so wet? And why was everything moving? "What the hell are you doing?" Rand barked. Rain and seawater were pelting against the windscreen. "We're in real trouble here." As she attempted to rise from the bench, the deck heaved sideways. The door flew open with a bang, rain and wind blasting into the pilot house. Another groan from deep within the hull, and the deck began to heel in the opposite direction. Lore went tumbling, sliding down the deck and smacking into the bulkhead. For a moment it seemed that they would just keep going, but then the motion reversed. Gripping the edge of the table for balance, she fought her way upright. "When the hell did this start?" Rand was clutching the edge of the pilot seat. "About 30 minutes ago. It just whipped up from nowhere." They were taking the sea broadside. The lightning flashed, the heavens shook, huge waves were crashing over the rails. "Get below and fire the engines," she ordered. "That'll use the rest of our fuel." "No choice." She strapped herself into the pilot seat. Water was sloshing over the floor. "Without helm control, this is going to pound us to pieces. I just hope we have enough left to get through this. We'll need all the thrust you've got." As Rand exited, Caleb appeared out of the storm. The man's face was white as a ghost's. Whether with terror or seasickness, Lore couldn't tell. "Is everyone below?" she asked. "Are you kidding me? It's like a screaming contest down there." She yanked the straps tight. "This is going to be rough, Caleb. We need every hatch sealed. Tell people to tie themselves down however they can." He nodded grimly, turned to go. "And shut that fucking door!" The ship heeled into the next trough, listing at a perilous angle before rolling up the other side. With nearly all of their fuel gone, they had no ballast. It wouldn't take much to capsize them. She looked at her watch. It was 05:30. Dawn would soon be breaking. "God damn it, Rand," she muttered. "Come on, come on." The pressure gauges leapt. Power flowed through the panel. Lore set the rudder, gripped the throttle control, and opened it wide. The compass was spinning like a top. With excruciating slowness, the bow began to turn into the wind. "Come on, girl!" The bow bit and held, plummeting into the next trough as if down a mountainside. Spray blasted over the deck. For a second, the front of the ship was almost fully submerged. Then it ascended, the hull rearing upward like a great rising beast. "That's the way," Lore shouted. "Do it for Mama!" She drove into the howling darkness. For 12 full hours, the storm raged. Many times, as giant waves crashed over the bow, Lore believed the end had come. Each time, the foredeck plunged into the abyss. Each time, it rose again. The storm did not so much fade as simply stop. One second the wind was howling, the rain lashing. In the next, it was all over. It was as if they had simply passed from one room into the next, one of violence, the other of almost perfect calm. With cramped hands, Lore unfastened her straps. She had no idea what was going on below decks, nor did this question at that moment concern her very much. She was tired and thirsty and badly needed to pee. She squatted over the pot she kept in the pilot house and stepped outside to toss the contents over the side. The clouds had begun to break apart. She stood at the rail for a moment and watched the evening sky. She had no idea where they were. She hadn't been able to read the compass since the storm had begun. They had survived, but at what cost? Their fuel was nearly exhausted. Beneath the stern of the Bergensfjord, the screws were softly churning, pushing them through the motionless sea. Rand emerged from the main hatch and descended the stairs toward her. He took a place beside her at the rail. "I've got to admit, it sure is pretty out here," he said. "Funny how it's like that after a storm." "What's the situation below decks?" His shoulders were slumped, his eyes rimmed with dark circles of fatigue. A bit of something, vomit perhaps, was caught in his beard. "We've got the bilges working. We should be dry pretty soon. You have to hand it to Michael. The guy knew how to build a boat." "Any injuries?" Rand shrugged. "Few broken bones, I heard. Some cuts and scrapes. Sarah's taking care of it. Lucky thing no one's going to want to eat for a week, seeing as how we're so low on food. The smell is pretty bad down there." He looked at her for a moment, then said carefully, "Want me to shut down the engines?" "It's your call." She considered this question. "In a minute," she said. For a while they stood together without talking, watching the sun descend over the starboard side. The last of the clouds were separating, lit from within by a purpling light. An area of water near the port bow had begun to boil with fish, feeding near the surface. As Lore watched, a large bird with black-tipped wings and a yellowish head swooped low over the surface, reached down with its bill, a quick, sharp jab, hauled the fish free, tossed it backward into its gullet, and began to climb away. "Rand, that's a bird." "I know it's a bird. I've seen birds before." "Not in the middle of the ocean, you haven't." She darted into the pilot house and returned with the binoculars. Her pulse was racing. Her heart was in her mouth. She pressed the lenses to her eyes and scanned the horizon. "Anything?" She held up a hand. "Quiet." She made a slow circle, facing due south. She stopped. "Lore, what are you seeing?" She held the image in the lenses for an extra few seconds to be sure. "Holy damn," she thought. She lowered the binoculars. "Get Greer up here," she said. By the time they were able to bring him up on deck, darkness was falling. Lucius did not appear to be in pain. That part had passed. His eyes were closed. He did not seem to know where he was or what was happening. With Sarah supervising, Caleb and Hollis served as stretcher bearers. Others had gathered around. Word had spread throughout the ship. Pim was there, with Theo and the girls, Jenny and Hannah, Jock and Grace, holding their infant son, the men of the crew, weary after the long battle of the storm. All stood aside as the stretcher passed. They carried him to the bow and lowered the gurney. Lore crouched beside him and wrapped one hand with her fingers. His skin was cold and dry, loose on the bones. "Lucius, it's Lore." From deep in his throat, a soft moan. "I have something to show you. Something wonderful." She slipped the palm of her left hand beneath his neck and gently tipped his face forward toward the bow. "Open your eyes," she said. His lids separated to make the thinnest slits, then a little more. It was as if he were using the last of his strength to perform this tiny act. All stood silent, waiting. The island was well within sight now, directly ahead, a single mountain, lushly green, soaring from the sea. And above it, a cross of five bright stars, punching through the twilight. "Do you see?" she whispered. The breath in his chest was barely a presence. Death was in his face. A long moment passed as he struggled to focus. At last, the faintest of smiles curled his lips.
"It's beautiful," Greer said.
86. Lucius Greer lived three more days, thus earning the distinction of being the first settler on the island, as yet unnamed, to die upon its soil. He spoke no more words. It could not have been said that he regained full consciousness. Yet, from time to time, as Sarah or one of the others attended to him, the smile would reappear, as if rising from a happy dream. They buried him in a clearing surrounded by tall palms with a view of the sea. Apart from the men who had worked on the boat, few of the ship's complement knew the man, or even who he was, least of all the children, who had heard only vague rumors of a dying man in a cabin, and whose shouts of play could be heard throughout the ceremony. Nobody minded. It seemed suitable. Lore was the first to speak, followed by Rand and Sarah. They had decided in advance that each would tell a story. Lore spoke of his friendship with Michael. Rand, the tales Greer had told him about his life in the expeditionary. Sarah, the day she and Greer had met, so many years ago in Colorado, and all that had happened there. When this was done, they formed a line so each could place a stone upon the grave, which bore a simple marker Lore had fashioned from pieces of driftwood. Lucius Greer, seer, soldier, friend. It was the next morning that a small group used two of the dinghies to return to the Bergensfjord, which waited at anchor 1,000 yards offshore. There had been some disagreement on the matter. The ship contained all manner of usable materials, but Lore was firm, and as captain had final say. "We let her rest," she told them. "It's what Michael wanted." She had not, in fact, opened Michael's letter until their second day on the island, by which time she had begun to suspect what it said. She could not say why this should be so. Perhaps it was merely her sense of the man. Thus it was without undue surprise, only a pleasant sense of hearing his voice, that she read the three simple sentences the letter contained. "Look in aft storage locker number 16. Scuttle the ship. Start over. Love, M." The storage locker contained a crate of explosives, as well as spools of cable and a radio detonator. Michael had left instructions for their proper distribution. Caleb and Hollis ran the cables through the passageways, while Lore and Rand distributed the explosives throughout the hull. The fuel tanks, now nearly empty, were full of highly combustible diesel fumes. Lore turned on the mixers, opened the valves, and set the final charge. There was no further discussion about what would happen next. The job was Lore's. The men returned to the dinghies. Lore took a final tour through the ship, its silent rooms and passageways. She thought of Michael as she walked. For the two, Michael and the Bergensfjord, were one and the same in her mind. She was sad, but also full of gratitude for all he had given her. She ascended to the deck and headed aft. The detonator was a small metal box operated by a key. She removed the key, which she wore on a chain around her neck, and carefully inserted it into the slot. Rand and the others were waiting below in their boats. "Goodbye, Michael." She turned the key and dashed for the stern. Beneath her, explosions were ripping through the hull, headed toward the fuel tanks. She hit the fantail at a dead sprint, took three long steps, and launched. Lore de Vere, captain of the Bergensfjord, airborne. She entered the water cleanly, with barely a splash. All around her, a beautiful blue world appeared. She rolled onto her back and gazed upward. A few seconds passed. Then a flash of light lit the surface. The water shook with a muffled boom. She emerged just a few yards from the boats. Behind her, the Bergensfjord was in flames, a huge cloud of black smoke soaring skyward. Caleb helped her in. "That was a nice dive," he said. She sat on a bench. The Bergensfjord was sinking from the stern. As its bow lifted clear of the water, exposing its massive, bulbous nose, shouts went up from the beach. The children, thrilled by the marvelous display, were cheering. When the hull reached a 45-degree angle, the ship began to slide backward, accelerating with astonishing speed. Lore closed her eyes. She did not want to witness the final moment. When she opened them, the Bergensfjord was gone. They rowed back toward shore. As they approached the beach, Sarah came jogging down the sand to meet them. "Caleb, I think you'd better come," she said. Pim's membranes had ruptured. Caleb found her underneath a tarp hung between trees on one of the thin mattresses they'd stripped from the Bergensfjord. Her face was calm, though damp in the tropical heat. During the last few weeks, her hair had grown incomparably thick, its color deepening to a rich chestnut that flared with red in the sun. "Hey," he signed. "Hey yourself." Then, with a smile, "You should see your expression. Don't worry, I'll be done in no time." He looked at Sarah. How was she really? He was signing simultaneously. No secrets. Not now. "I don't see any problems. She's only a little short of her due date. And she's right. For a second birth, things tend to go faster." Theo's birth had taken forever, nearly 20 hours from the first contraction to the last. It had just about crushed Caleb with worry, though less than a minute after Theo hit the air, Pim was all smiles, demanding to hold him. "Just hang around," Sarah told him. "Hollis can look after Theo and the girls." Caleb could tell that there was something the woman wasn't saying. He moved away, Sarah following. "Out with it," he said. "Well, the thing is, I'm hearing 2 heartbeats. 2, he repeated. "Twins, Caleb." He stared at her. "And you didn't know this until now?" "Sometimes it happens." She reached out and took him by the upper arm. "She's strong. She's done this before."
"Not with 2.
"It's not so very different until the end." "Good God. How am I going to tell them apart?" A foolish concern, and yet it was the first thought to enter his mind. "You'll figure it out. Plus, they might not be identical."
"Really? How does that work?"
She laughed lightly. "You don't know the first thing about this, do you?" His stomach churned with anxiety. "I guess not."
"Just stay with her.
The contractions are still far apart. There's really nothing for me to do at this point. Hollis will keep the kids amused." She gave him a parental look. "Okay?" Caleb nodded. He felt completely overwhelmed. "Attaboy," she said. He watched her head down the beach and returned to the shelter. Pim was jotting in her notebook. It was one he hadn't seen before, handsomely bound with leather. A bottle of ink sat on the sand beside her, as well as a pile of books from Hollis's stash. Pim looked up, closing the diary with a muffled clap as Caleb sat on the sand.
"She told you?"
"Yes." Pim, too, was grinning at him in a manner that verged on laughter. He felt like he'd wandered into the wrong room at a party, one in which everybody knew everybody else, and he knew exactly no one.
"Relax," she signed. "It's no big deal."
"How do you know?"
"Because women know."
She drew a sharp breath, her face scrunching with pain. Caleb saw it in her eyes. Her light-hearted attitude was a cover. His wife was steeling herself for what would come. Hour by hour, she would go further away from him, into the place where all her strength came from.
"Pim? Okay?"
A few seconds went by. Her face relaxed as she expelled a long breath. She tipped her head at the pile of books.
"Read to me."
He lifted the first volume from the pile. Caleb had never been much for reading. He found it tedious, no matter how much his father-in-law had attempted to persuade him otherwise. At least the title made sense to him. War and Peace. Perhaps, contrary to all his expectations, it would actually be interesting. The book was enormous. It felt like it weighed 10 pounds. He opened the cover and turned to the first page, which was covered in dispiritingly minuscule print, like a wall of ink. "You're sure about this?" he signed. Pim's eyes were bright, her hands folded together over her belly.
"Yes, please. It's one of my father's favorites. I've been meaning to read it for ages. Full of dread, yet anxious to please her, Caleb sat on the sand, balanced the book on his lap, and began to sign.
"Well, Prince, Genoa and Lucca are now no more than private estates of the Bonaparte family. No, I warn you that if you do not tell me we are at war, if you again allow yourself to palliate all the infamies and atrocities of this Antichrist, upon my word I believe he is, I don't know you in future. You are no longer my friend, no longer my faithful slave, as you say." And so on. Caleb was totally baffled. Nothing seemed to be happening, just obscure conversations that went nowhere, full of references to places and characters he couldn't keep track of, even a little. The signing was laborious, many words he did not know and had to spell out. Yet Pym seemed to be enjoying herself. At unforeseen moments, she would issue small sighs of pleasure, or her eyes would widen with anticipation, or she would smile at what Caleb supposed was the book's equivalent of a joke. It wasn't long before his hands were exhausted. Pym's contractions continued, the gaps between them shortening over time while their durations increased. When this happened, Caleb would pause in his reading, waiting for the pain to end. Pym would nod to tell him it was over, and he would begin reading again. The hours moved by. Sarah visited at regular intervals, taking Pym's pulse, touching her belly here and there, reporting that all was well, things were moving normally. Of War and Peace, she only remarked, eyebrows raised, "Good luck." Others came by, Lore and Rand, Jenny and Hannah, as well as several people Pym had befriended on the ship. In mid-afternoon, Hollis brought Theo and the girls. The boy could have cared less, sitting on the ground beside his mother and attempting to fill his mouth with sand. But for the girls, the birth of a cousin, not just one, but magically a pair of them, was a long-anticipated excitement, like a present waiting to be unwrapped. During their weeks on the ship with little to amuse them, Elle's signing had improved. No longer was she limited to the most elementary phrases. With Pym, she chattered away, oblivious to the woman's discomfort, though Pym didn't seem to mind, or if she did, managed not to show it. "All right," Hollis said finally, clapping his hands together. "Your aunt needs a rest. Let's go look for shells, shall we?" The girls complained, but off they went, Theo riding his grandfather's hip. Pym's eyes followed them. "She looks so much like Kate," she sighed. "Which one?" She paused. "Both of them." The afternoon faded. Caleb had become aware of a certain energy being directed at the tent from multiple directions. Word had gone around. A baby was being born. Eventually, Pym told him to stop reading. "Let's save the rest for later," she said, by which she meant nothing besides having these babies is going to happen for a while. The contractions intensified, long and deep. Caleb called for Sarah. A quick exam. Then she looked at him pointedly. "Go wash your hands. We'll need a couple of clean towels, too." Jenny had heated a pot of water. Caleb did as Sarah instructed and returned to the tent. Pym had begun to make a great deal of noise. The sounds she made were different than other people's. There was something more raw about them, almost animalistic. Sarah hiked up Pym's skirt and laid one of the towels beneath her pelvis. "Ready to push?" Pym nodded. "Caleb, sit next to her. I need you to translate what I say." The next contraction seized her. Pym clamped her eyes tight, raising her knees and bending her chin to her chest. "That's the way," Sarah said. "Keep going." Another few seconds, torturous to Caleb, and then Pym relaxed, gasping for breath, her head falling back onto the sand. Caleb hoped for some respite, but virtually no time passed before the next contraction. The long, listless afternoon had become a battle. Caleb took one of her hands and began to write in her palm. "I love you. You can do this." "Here we go," said Sarah. Pym coiled and bore down. Sarah had placed her hands beneath Pym's pelvis with her palms open, as if to catch a ball. A dark, round cap of hair appeared,
slithered back inside, then emerged once more. Pym was puffing rapidly through pursed lips.
"One more time," Sarah said.
Caleb signed the words, though Pym took no notice. It hardly mattered. Her body was in control now. She was merely following its commands. She gripped Caleb's arm for balance, rose up, and buried her fingers into his flesh as every part of her compressed. The head appeared again, and then the shoulders. With a slippery sound, the baby slid free into Sarah's hands.
A girl. The baby was a girl.
Sarah passed her to Jenny, who was kneeling beside her. Jenny quickly snipped the cord and balanced the baby along her forearm. Cupping the baby's face with her palm, she began to rub her tiny, blue-skinned back with a tender, circular motion. The air of the shelter had a smoky smell, as well as a note of something sweet, almost floral. The baby made a small, wet sound, like a sneeze.
"Piece of cake," Jenny said with a smile.
"We're not done here, Caleb," Sarah said. "The next one's yours."
"You're kidding.
You have to earn your keep around this place. Just follow Jenny's lead." Pym rocked forward again. Her last push seemed less effortful. The path had been cleared. A single sustained straining, and the second child arrived.
A boy.
Sarah passed him to Caleb. The cord, a glistening rope of veins, was still attached. The boy was warm against Caleb's skin, his color dull, almost gray. He placed his son along his arm as Jenny had done, and began to rub. The lightness of his body was stupendous. How astounding that a person could grow from this small thing, that not just people, but every living creature upon the earth had begun this way. Caleb felt swept into a miracle. Something soft and wet filled his palm. The baby's chest expanded with a gulp of air. One life had left them. Now two had entered. Pym, her face glazed with relief, was already holding their daughter. Sarah cut the cord, washed the little boy with a damp cloth, wrapped him in a blanket, and gave him back to Caleb. An unanticipated longing washed over him. How he wished his father were here. For weeks he had kept this feeling at bay. Holding his son in his arms, he could no longer. Tears poured from his eyes. 87. They named the girl Kate. The boy was Peter. 2 months had passed. Quickly the joy of the settlers' arrival had been put aside as everyone turned to the concerns of making the island a home. Hunting parties were organized, food gathered, fishing nets laid, vines harvested, and trees felled for the construction of shelters. The island seemed eager to fulfill their needs. Many things were new. Bananas, coconuts, huge tusked boars, nasty as hell and not to be messed with, but which, when taken, provided bountiful meat. In the jungle, less than 100 yards from the beach, a mountain stream, descending in a dazzling waterfall, filled a rocky grotto with water so cold and fresh it made their heads pound. It was Hollis who suggested that the first civic structure should be a school. This seemed sensible. Without something to organize their days, the children would run wild as mice. He selected a site, organized a party, and got to work. When Caleb happened to mention that they had very few books, the big man laughed. "Seems to me we're starting over in more ways than one," he said. "I guess we'll just have to write some." It did not take long for the memories of their old life to recede. That was perhaps the most amazing thing. Everything was new. The food they ate, the air they breathed, the sound of the wind in the palm fronds, the rhythm of days. It was as if a blade had fallen onto their lives, carving it into a time before and a time after. Ghosts were always with them, the people they had lost. Yet everywhere, on the beach and in the jungle, was always the sound of children. The mantle of leadership had naturally fallen to Lore. At first, she'd demurred. "What do I know about running a town?" yet the precedent had been set. That she'd been captain was hard to put aside in people's minds, and she commanded the respect not only of the crew who had served under her, but of the people she had brought safely to shore. A vote was held. Over her objections, which had come to seem only half-hearted, she was elected by acclaim. Some discussion followed as to what her title should be. She opted for mayor. She organized a cabinet of sorts. Sarah would be in charge of all medical matters. Jenny and Hollis would oversee the school. Rand and Caleb would supervise construction of all the residential structures. Jock, who'd turned out to be a fine shot with a bow, would organize the hunting parties, and so on. They had yet to investigate much of the island, which was far bigger than it had originally appeared. It was decided that two scouting parties would set out, circling the mountain in opposite directions. Rand led one party, Caleb the other. They returned a week later, reporting that the island, rather than standing alone, was the southernmost of what appeared to be a chain. Two more were visible from the high cliffs of the island's northern side, with a third, perhaps, lurking in the far distance. They had also found no traces of prior inhabitation. That did not mean it wasn't there. Perhaps one day they would discover evidence that people had been here before. But for now, the island's unspoiled quality, its wildness and beneficence, spoke in tones of solitude. It was a hopeful time. Not without cares. There was much to do. But they had begun. For many weeks, Pim had been considering what to do with her book. The work was complete, the words polished. Of course, the story it told went only so far. The end was unknown to her. But she had done all she could. The decision to bury it, or in some similar manner conceal it, had come upon her slowly and with some surprise. She had long supposed that eventually she would show it to other people. Yet day by day, the idea grew that these writings were not, in fact, for anyone still living, but served a grander purpose. She attributed this intuition to the same mysterious influence that had led her to write these pages in the first place, and to write them as she had. One early morning, not long after Caleb's return from scouting the island, she awoke to a feeling of great calm. Caleb and the children were still asleep. Pim rose quietly, gathered her journal and shoes, and stepped outside. The first rays of dawn were crawling upward from the horizon. Soon, the settlement would awaken. But for now, Pim had the beach to herself. The world had a way of speaking to you if you let it. The trick was learning to hear. She stood for a moment, savoring the quiet, listening for what the world was telling her this morning. She turned away from the water and headed into the jungle. She had no destination. She would let her feet carry her where they chose. She found herself walking beneath thick foliage roughly parallel with the beach, perhaps 200 yards inland. All of this had been explored, of course. Dew was dripping from the leaves. The rising sun saturated the jungle canopy with a warm green light. The ground became uneven, folded into rocky ridges. At times she was forced to crawl on her hands and knees. At the top of a ridge, she saw below her a gentle depression, guarded on three sides by rock walls roped with vines. Jeweled beads of water trickled down the face of the farthest wall, collecting at the base in a pool. She carefully descended. Something about this place felt new and undiscovered. It possessed a feeling of sanctuary. Crouched by the pool, she filled her cupped hands and drank. The water was clean and tasted like stone. She rose and surveyed her surroundings. Something was here. She could sense it. Something she was meant to find. As she scanned the rocky perimeter, her eyes fell upon a zone of shadow within the dense vegetation. She made her way toward it. It was a cave, the opening curtained by vines. She drew them aside. Here was a likely place, indeed an ideal place, in which to conceal her journal. She reached down into the pocket of her dress. Yes, a box of matches, one of the last. She scraped a match on the striker and extended it into the cave's mouth. The space was not especially large, more like the room of a house. The match burned down to her fingertips. She extinguished it with a flick of her wrist, struck a second, and followed its light inside. At once, Pym became aware that she had entered not merely a natural formation, but somebody's home. The space was furnished with a table, a large bed, and two chairs, all fashioned from rough-cut logs roped together with vines. Other objects, similarly primitive in their manufacture, littered the floor. Simple stone tools, baskets of dried fronds woven together, plates and cups of unfired clay. She lit another match and approached the bed. Shadows stretched before her, revealing a human form beneath the brittle blanket. She drew it aside. The body, what persisted of it, dried bones the color of wood, a whorl of hair, lay curled on its side, its arms tucked protectively against its chest. Whether male or female, Pym could not discern. Carved into the wall beside the bed were a series of marks, small slashes cut into the stone. Pym counted 32. Did they represent days? Months? Years? The bed was unnecessarily large for one person. There were two chairs, not one. Somewhere, probably not far, would be the grave of the cave's other inhabitant. Pym stepped outside. That she was meant to conceal her journal in this place was apparent. The cave was a repository of the past. Still, she longed to know more. Who were these people? Where had they come from? How had they died? Standing at the edge of the pool, she could feel the presence of these silenced lives. She made her way around the walls. Gradually, as if a veil had lifted from her eyes, other artifacts emerged. Shards of pottery, a wooden spoon, a circle of stones where a fire had once been laid. On the far side of the pool, she came to a tangle of bushes with thick, waxy leaves. Something lurked behind it, a curved shape, bulging from the ground. It was a boat. More precisely, a lifeboat. The fiberglass hull, about 20 feet long, was settled deeply into the soil. Vines entwined it, rendering it nearly invisible. A thick duff of organic matter carpeted the bottom, small plants growing from it. How long had it rested here, slowly sinking into the jungle floor? Years? Decades? Even more? She circled the hull, hunting for clues. It yielded nothing until she reached the stern. Affixed to the transom, partially obscured by vegetation, was a wooden plaque, faded, brittle, riven with rot. Spectral letters were etched into its surface. She crouched and pulled the vines aside. For a time, she did not move, so profound was her astonishment. How could it be so? But as the minutes passed, a new feeling rose within her. She remembered the storm, the great wind howling down, carrying them to shore when all seemed lost. Destiny was too small a word. There was a force at work that ran far deeper, a thread woven into the fabric of all things. When more time had elapsed, she rose and returned to the clearing. She had no intentions. She was acting by instinct. At the edge of the pool, she knelt once more. There, in the water's placid surface, she beheld the image of her face. A young face, smooth and unlined, though this, she knew, would change. Time would have its way, as it did for everyone. Her babies would grow. She and all the people she loved would recede, becoming memories, then memories of memories, and finally nothing at all. It was a sad thought, but it also made her happy in a way that felt new. This island of refuge, it was meant to be theirs. It had waited for them all along, so that history could begin again. That's what the words on the plaque had told her. Perhaps a time would come when it would feel